Welcome to Diffusion, a podcast of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. In this new nine-part series, we're discussing peacebuilding in Africa. I'm Scott Malcolmson.
I'm Aaron Stanley. Scott and I spent 2 weeks in Kenya and Ethiopia talking with experts in the peacebuilding field. This first episode focuses on ethnicity in East Africa.
Tribe and ethnic group are sensitive terms in East Africa and the Horn, not least because of their use by imperial powers. The modern independent nation-state was meant to replace these ties. Instead, they've taken on new shapes and new power, fueling conflict but also providing solidarity.
As we will hear in a minute, the consensus on the issue has broken down. We begin with Jok Madut Jok, who is the executive director of the Sud Institute in South Sudan and a former government minister.
The African state was created by the colonialists.
Right, of course.
And now, when colonialism ended, on average, Africans confronted the same question, which is, what do we do with this thing now that we have inherited from colonialism? Do we keep it the way it was created in the image of the colonial master? In which case, you will have to use the same tools that the colonialists used in order to keep the country one, including violence. Or do we dismantle it and return our country back to where it used to be, where every ethnic group was a nation on its own? In which case, you will have thousands of countries on the African continent, which was not viable in 1960.
64 in South Sudan.
Right. So then it was not longer possible to return Africa to the pre-colonial existence. So the choice was made by African leaders at that time. People like Kwame Nkrumah, like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, all of them agreed that the colonial state must stay and its boundaries cannot be touched. And in order for these states to become nations, the tribe has to go away. So they endeavored to imbue the African citizen with a sense of citizenship in a larger entity beyond the tribe. And that has been a problem, right? You try to do away with the ethnic group while trying to maintain the very essence of the identity of the African people, which is rooted in their tribe. So you have that mix. You have a state that controls everybody but cannot control everybody in a successful way, in ways that are persuasive rather than coercive. It has not happened.
We're looking at four case studies: Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, and Kenya.
Solomon Durso is the commissioner at the African Commission on Human and People's Rights and an Ethiopian scholar.
I have to say that I think much of my understanding of peace and security issues, but most importantly, inter-ethnic relationships and dynamics and what it means to belong to a particular ethnic group in a diverse society like ours, has been informed by what this country has gone through historically, and also at the formative ages of my youth. So certainly it is shaped a great deal by what I have seen and also the change that I have experienced that other country has transitioned from the Derg to the new dispensation of the APRDF.
The Derg was the left-wing group that overthrew Emperor Haile Selassie in 1974 and put the country under harsh authoritarian rule.
In 1991, the Derg was overthrown in a civil war by the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, better known by its acronym EPRDF. This coalition of four ethnic parties continues to rule today.
When, you know, the civil war started, there was a contestation between groups that define the problem of the Ethiopian state as essentially being one of class. And there were those who defined principally the Ethiopian problem as one of failure to accommodate the diversity, recognize and accommodate the diversity of the different ethnocultural groups in the country. And in the process, of course, those who were on the side of the second group succeeded in mobilizing and also in defeating in mobilizing against and defeating the Derg. And when they came, of course, they have both a leftist, including the ones that were defining things, defining the problem in terms of class, and the ones that were defining the major problem in terms of
ethnocultural representation.
Absolutely. But historically, the way they mobilized and organized their mobilization and also their campaign was on the basis of leftist arrangements. So
leftist arrangements.
Exactly, and leftist principles. So that is what democratic centralism owes its origin to. Mm-hmm. All right. So when during the armed struggle period, that's how they were. They were organized, mm-hmm. and democratic centralism was the basis on which they have organized and they have evolved historically. Mm-hmm. And when they came here, it was therefore, as far as decision making process is concerned, something that they didn't abandon. So that is how you have this combination of, on the one hand, different members. Actually, PRDF is a coalition of four parties. Mm-hmm. All right. But the four parties claim to represent particular regions of the country.
Right.
The major regions of the country, not all ethnic groups of the country, actually.
Well, you have one for the Tigrayans in the north, one for the
Amhara. Exactly, absolutely. So that is the kind of thing that they made. I think the trouble, obviously, is that combining, it must be such a very delicate balance to make. Mm. Okay, on the one hand, you have this highly centralized decision-making process. On the one hand, you also say that you actually give some autonomous space for decision-making for others, all right? Getting the balance between these two is an extremely difficult. It brought about representation, without a doubt. It also gave recognition to the languages and cultures of the different groups.
From the point of view of the strengthening regions with their ethnicized politics, the democratic centralism of the national government in Addis Ababa began to seem far away.
And also it created a self-government structure at the regional level that enabled the regions to create their own center of power in terms of economic development, in terms of having local elites controlling what happens in their own localities, in terms of using their own language. People start to say, despite the fact that we have a self-government structure, we are not really self-determining, actually. Mm. We are not self-governing because decisions are made at the center. And then we are just, you know, becoming a pipeline for, you know, passing on and implementing those decisions. So that hyper-centralization of decision-making, not only in political terms, but also in socioeconomic terms.
Mm-hmm. The Ethiopian synthesis of a strong central government and ethnically inflected regional governments looked fairly stable until a few years ago.
But by the time of our conversations, Ethiopia was in a state of emergency. The key question was how to rebalance the ethnic distribution of power in order to preserve the viability of the Ethiopian state. Somalia is dominated by the Somali ethnicity, but society is divided by lineage groups commonly referred to as clans. Clans are broken down into subclans and sub-subclans.
Colonial borders divided up the Somali ethnic group across the Horn of Africa. Beginning in the 1980s, years of civil war, followed by very weak central governance, and finally the rise of the insurgency Al-Shabaab, have created a huge Somali population living outside of Somalia. We discussed these dynamics with Sagal Abshir, a lawyer, former Somali government advisor, consultant, and researcher.
This whole issue of the state, you know, and recreating the state, you know, a lot of people will ask, a lot of African colleagues will say, but we don't understand. You've got one language and one religion and one people. Like, what is it that you're, you know, not agreeing? And that was sort of the myth of Greater Somalia, was to bring all the Somali peoples into one state. The Somali flag is a blue background with a five-pointed white star. And that star represents the five parts of Somalia that the founders of the country had dreamed of bringing back together. And the five parts were the Italian, what they called Italian Somaliland, that had been colonized by the Italians, which is sort of the long eastern part of the country. British Somaliland, which was along the north of the country, which is the part of the country today called Somaliland. French Somaliland, which is today Djibouti. The Ethiopian Somalia, which is the eastern region of Ethiopia. And the northeastern part of Kenya. That was the dream of the Somali creators of the nation, and it was known as Greater Somalia. Somalia in 1960, when we did gain independence, succeeded in bringing together two of those 5 points, which was the British and the Italian, became what we know as Somalia. Today we have a situation where the two where we did manage to bring together have also split apart, and you have one of them seeking recognition as an independent state, that's Somaliland. So that dream is sort of, it's interesting because it's not my generation's dream, right? It's the previous generation's dream, but it still holds a very important part in the Somali imagination. And the questions of citizenship, which is another big open question in our constitution process. Who's a Somali citizen? Under the former constitution, any Somali is a Somali citizen, which is an interesting legal...
and not even for just the Horn of Africa region, but now that there's such a Somali diaspora as well, that would complicate it even further.
Yeah, we've got a significant diaspora, as you mentioned. Our diaspora send back $1.3 billion a year, which is about equal to the humanitarian and development spending per year. I think one of the resources is our diaspora and the remittances that come back, and the networks and the systems that have come into existence. And we're literally the resilience of the commercial side and, of course, the personal side to continue to exist 30 years without a central, without a government. I mean, I think this is like, we're now in the arena of like that whole Westphalian concept of you have to have a state to have certain things. I mean, Somalia's disproved it. It exists.
Rashid Abdi is a former journalist for the BBC and Kenya's Daily Nation. He now heads the Horn of Africa program at International Crisis Group and was Crisis Group's Somalia analyst for years.
I think the problem with Somalia isn't even Al-Shabaab. You know, the problem with Somalia is actually the clans. The inability of the clans to create a functional state, not at the national level, but at the local level. In Somalia's case, is a classic example. You create an ethnic state or an ethnic subnational state. That does not create a cohesive society. It actually legitimizes other competing sub-national interests. Let me explain. Somali clan system is a tree, like, you know, whereby there is the main family and then there are sub-clans within. So there are small entities within, all of them with very strong vested interest. Once you create, once you legitimize the ethnic federal system, you also begin to open up the system to other competing sub ethnic. You know, there's a tiny enclave in Somalia, which I always use. It created itself and called itself Himan and Heb. It is slightly, it's the area of Nairobi sized, and the only glue that was holding this together was it was a sub-clan of the Hawiya.
What does Himan al-Heb mean?
Himan al-Heb, it's just a name. Okay. I can't even know where they picked it from.
Okay.
But then it was created right in the center of a bigger federal state called Galmudug. And so they were, you know, we said in one of our reports, this is not viable. You know, this is a town which basically, the river is on the other side. The main airport, airstrip, and even the infrastructure is on the other side. You know, how can you be viable as a federal entity? You know, and this is what I think also one ought to consider. You know, how can you simply use the idea of an ethnic, of, you know, the guiding principle as ethnicity to create a viable functioning federal state?
The new nation of South Sudan was born from decades of civil war waged by Southerners against the northern government based in Khartoum. Sudan and South Sudan became separate states in 2011. We return to Yok Marut Yok, the South Sudanese head of the Sud Institute, who spoke at the beginning of this episode.
The United States and the rest of the world in 2011 focused on building the state. So they gave more power and more resources to the political system, to the state. What they have failed to do concurrently is building a sense of citizenship in that state, such that people graduate from their citizenship in the community and the ethnic group into a sense of collective citizenship in the nation. That disconnect is part of the problem today.
What do you think remains of a sense of citizenship in South Sudan in a situation where half of the population is in IDP camps or outside the borders, and where the political elite has now failed for a number of years to even resolve the differences amongst themselves? Mm-hmm.
So with regards to the question of whether in the context of displacement and flight into refugee camps by so many citizens, the state has not only flagrantly failed, which is the reason why people are fleeing, it has also been a perpetrator of the causes of that flight. Where is the tribe then now that people are fleeing the country and the tribe is no longer capable of providing the protection now that the state is not doing it? And I think the tribe has become stronger. Even when people flee, they flee to areas they know they will be able to converge with their relatives and with their community members, such that if you go into an IDP camp, you find that the groupings of people are grouped according to those ethnic groups. What it has done is actually strengthen the affinity between members of the ethnic group as opposed to others, right? So in a sense, it has fragmented the country further along ethnic lines. It has given some of the political leaders the legitimacy they would never have otherwise. On a simple, simplistic basis that they are members of your community, they support you to become a political leader. So in a sense, you can say there is a very thin line, sometimes actually not so thin a line, connecting the usual communal conflicts, the fight over resources between one community and the next along ethnic lines. Now it has. There is an ability of the political leadership to manipulate that communal level conflict and appropriate that communal power to give themselves a legitimacy to control the state at the national level. So in a sense, the communal conflict, there was a time when you could distinguish the communal conflict, which have always been there by virtue of human nature, from civil wars, which are particularly confined to elites. Between the government elite and the opposition elite, they fought over power. But now that the society at the seams is becoming undone, the political leaders can bank on their ethnic communities to give themselves legitimacy. And again, from the top, the country is becoming fragmented, and at the bottom, it is becoming completely undone, such that if you ever have a chance to reflect on how to bring South Sudan back from the brink, those are the things that you have to focus on.
George Gathigi is a lecturer at the University of Nairobi.
The question of ethnicity always features in every conversation. And you have to go back to colonialism and how, you know, our colonizers sort of divided the Kenyan communities. Before we had East Africa, for example, you'll find different ethnicities spread across Kenya and Uganda. The Luo across spread between Kenya and Uganda, or the Luyas, and also Luos, Kenya and Tanzania. You have Maasais in Kenya. You have Somalis in Somalia and Kenya. You have the Oromos in Ethiopia. So these artificial boundaries, of course, and you know, people used to have, traditionally we had small, nation states.
which is what we now call ethnicity or ethnic groups. And all these have had different way, of social and political organizations. So come colonialism and everybody is put in their own group, and the colonizers identify different resources. If you are in the Central Highlands, so you have maybe Kikuyus, Merus, and Maasai, and you are pushed out and all that. And then if you are displaced, then you are going to have more grievances than people who maybe have not been displaced. Or you go to the Luos and you think they can provide labor, you bring them to the size of plantations. So there was that, there was that division that was created way from the colonial period. Then independence, and then so these ethnic fractures, of course, continued. And of course, the political class has always utilized these, you divide and rule. So they borrowed the same card that the colonizers took. If my political leader tells me the reason why you don't have access to drinking water is because we haven't gotten a chance to the national cake, and that is the phrase we use. So when you get to the government, you have access to the national cake, and therefore it is an opportunity for your people to eat or to get the goodies. Then people tend to view their non-co-ethnic, even when they are poor, as their enemies, because the reason why we don't have what we have is because of your person who is there. So this has been more of the politics. So the political class uses the ethnic card to entice the people to access to certain resources, to certain services and all that. While in my view, the reality is a little bit different. During independence, then we did not make effort, for example, to pull those who were left behind. So our system has perpetuated this, and it has in turn increase the grievances for those who feel genuinely left behind.
I was going to be an investment banker until December 2007.
Nanjala Nayabola is an independent researcher and Kenyan political commentator.
And then I came home for the first time. I had gone to the UK for my undergrad degree, and I came home for the first time with one semester left, and we had this big cataclysmic election. And the feeling of, well, two things happened. One is the feeling of impotence. At the time, my family was living in Langata, which is right next to Kibera, which is this huge informal settlement. And there was a moment, I think it was December 30th, when we were sitting at home, and you could see sort of the horizon glowing orange because, you know, people's houses were on fire, and we couldn't do anything about it. And then the other thing was, I remember switching on CNN. There's a road in Nairobi, in Bagathi Way, which kind of dips into a valley, goes down to a river basin. And on one side is Kibera, and on the other side is, well, it used to be this empty lot. Now it's filled up with apartments. And so some of the people who were in Kibera had marched out of, this was about a week into the crisis, had marched out of the settlement and were waving white handkerchiefs and, you know, saying in Swahili and in the Luo, "We haven't had water for a week, we haven't had food for a week, are you trying to kill us?" Because they had been this barricade. And the CNN journalist was standing in front of them, and he said, "These people are upset because their chosen leader has not been elected."
The sounds of gunfire and sirens echo through Nairobi as supporters of President Mwai Kibaki and opposition candidate Raila Odinga try to settle on the street what they could not decide at the ballot box.
300 people have been killed in days of clashes in Kenya. Some 70,000 have fled their homes amid violence breaking down largely along tribal lines.
And I was furious. I was furious because he basically had like a 15-minute, you know, breaking news moment in which he was saying almost the exact opposite of what the people were saying. For me, the ethnic balance and the ethnic question in Kenya, one political decision that we can make is to put it in its rightful place and not to overstate its importance. And that does not mean that we pretend that it's not there or it's not an issue, but recognize that the two largest ethnic groups in the country, let's say the three largest,
the Kikuyu, the Luo,
and the Luya. Kalenjin are not even in the top, I think they're in the top five, but not in the top three. It's Kikuyu, then Luyas, then Luos, then Kamba, and then Kalenjin. Those five groups comprise 60% of the population of the country. The other 40% is divided between 30-something different groups. What's life like for those people? What's politics like? How do those people experience politics? And I think once you do that, you start to see a completely different calculation, and you start to really see how much power we give to this narrative at the expense of investing in understanding, you know, why did 70% of eligible voters not vote in October, the second rerun of the election? It wasn't because Raila asked them to stay home. It was because national politics does nothing for the vast majority of people in this country. The first thing people ask you when you arrive in Turkana is, how is Kenya? If you go to Marsabit, if you go to Mandera, it's the Garissa, it's the same. How is Kenya? Because there's this spatial almost segregation between these two parts of the country. And when you talk to those people about ethnicized politics and all of that, they look at you like they're crazy because it doesn't do anything for them. It doesn't matter whether the person in charge of Kenya is Kikuyu or Luo or Kamba or whatever. It doesn't do anything for them. You get a lot of mixed marriages in Kenya. And when women marry outside their ethnic group, they lose their ethnic identity most of the time. And so what does it mean, or how much credence or how much weight should we put to a concept when 51% of the population experiences it in a completely different way?
Returning to Rashid Abdi of International Crisis Group.
There has been no doubt a rise of ethnic identity politics and this is a phenomenon that has been there for a while. And this is something that happened as a sort of reaction to the post-colonial state.
Mm-hmm.
After independence, I think there was a lot of euphoria and a lot of galvanization of the entire, the collection of tribes came together because they had won a nation, they had created a nation. So this sustained, I think, many African countries in the first 10 years. So there was a lot of pan-African dreams, of one day creating a united state of Africa. So what we saw in the 80s and 70s was a reversal of that. The post-colonial state became actually, in many eyes, reactionary. It went back to becoming a single ethnic dominated state. Mm-hmm. In the case of Kenya, we saw how the Kikuyu basically captured power and basically created this massive ethnic state, mm-hmm. and controlled and became almost a thoroughly venal and very corrupt system, mm-hmm. under the Kenyatta government.
Mm-hmm.
And something similar was also happening elsewhere. The second generation of leaders who emerged were actually leaders who had no interest in Pan-Africanism or even creating a nation state.
Mm-hmm.
They were basically interested in advancing the interest of their ethnic communities.
Mm-hmm.
So we see this revival or this ethnic identity politics has become stronger. It exerts such powerful influence. In many ways, it is the organizing principle of politics now in many parts of the Horn of Africa. Kenya has also been experimenting with, a devolution process.
Right.
And Kenya, although Kenya has not called it ethnic federalism, in many ways it is de facto ethnicized.
Not to be critical of devolution, but it's easy to imagine a situation where 5 years from now you'll begin to have a generation in a given province where it'll be possible to get all your news in your vernacular language, mm-hmm. where the kids will learn their history in their own way, in their own language, and mm-hmm. so, mm-hmm. which on the one hand is praiseworthy in terms of preserving local cultures and not just steamrolling it all, or not having a single ethnicity, for example, the Kikuyu, just simply being the dominant one.
Right.
But at the same time, it would you can see how it would exacerbate mm-hmm. what amounts to a potentially an almost kind of feudal sort of political cultural economy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think devolution in the Kenyan context, but also in Ethiopia, if it works well, it has the potential of actually putting all these countries into very solid path towards stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
There are many odds against decentralization actually working. First of all, I mentioned a few minutes ago about the old centralizing bureaucracies, which are still intact and in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the president himself, you know, he's not a supporter of the devolution,
mm-hmm.
the current president in Kenya,
mm-hmm.
Because he belongs to that elite which feels that whittling away state power, central state power, is actually diminishes his authority. And we saw when he came into office, actually begin to tinker with the laws in order to bring back some functions back to the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is the constant battle.
What devolution has done that's good is that it's made local politics very important for people. People care about, in rural areas, and Kenya is, 67% rural. People care about who their MCA is. They care about who their senator is, and they care about who their MP is. But the flip side of it is, in a lot of places, it's made national politics even less important. And that can't be a problem.
In many ways, Africa is regressing back to a very old principle of organizing politics, which is around
a pre-colonial.
Mm. I think once you remove the idea of collective citizenship and begin to legitimize this competing ethnic interest,
mm-hmm.
you basically open a Pandora's box. All these emerging counties, federal states, are in many ways also ethnic ghettos. How can you simply use the idea of an ethnic, of, you know, the guiding principle as ethnicity to create a viable functioning federal state?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way in which you can actually create mergers between ethnic communities, mm-hmm. so that they can take care of a shared infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a classic example. There is a town called Isiolo, which is in central Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Isiolo borders another county called Meru,
mm-hmm.
and the two neighbors have had a very uneasy relationship over the years. Why? Because the Meru, who also are a tribe, migrated to Isiolo and began creating building. They are very enterprising, so they started building shops and so on. So the Meru, as an ethnic community, constitute now a very powerful, significant minority in Isiolo County.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And that has created border tensions. A smart engineer said, how can I bring the Meru and the Boran together?
Mm-hmm.
So they devised a clever
engineer. The Boran meaning the main group in Isiolo.
In Isiolo. Yeah. So they devised a very clever idea. They said, we are going to build an airport, and we are going to put it slap bang in the middle of the county, in the border.
The border, yeah. Right.
We are going to, because
wherever it exactly, is, it's going to be on both sides.
On both sides. How long does a runway? Runway is 3 kilometers. We will put 2 kilometers on one side, 1 kilometer in the other. We will put the terminal in the other and the runway in the other.
Mm.
And they did that.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, tensions began to subside.
The next episode of this podcast will be on international interventions.
I think countries like the United Kingdom in particular, there is a fatigue with big peacekeeping operations.